gentlemen.
It's
very nice. Boy, no talking, please.
She's a school teacher.
She's just explained that she's utterly dependent because she was once a school teacher and she expects bells to go at the end of 45 minutes. She can't remember what the time is and she talks in class. So, good morning. Very nice to see you all, and we're very flattered because we know we have very hot competition from next door. We were all bewildered by the title of this session, Operation Petticoat, it said, and yes. Emails began to go on about what century do they think we're in, and then we discovered that all these sessions were named after Cary Grant films, and this is why we've got this one. We don't have a theme, really. We're just wrenching. We're going to try and wrench a theme out of this session. My name is Ruth Dudley Edwards. I write satirical crime novels and other things, but this isn't about me, this is about them. And I'm going to ask them to do...
And you. We like your work. You can talk about you too.
I'm going to ask them to do the work for me because I think one of the most boring things in the world is listening to a moderator droning on with biographical details of people she doesn't really know. So I'm expecting everybody here to talk for... A minute is probably tops about the most interesting things about themselves. I will just say about the first speaker that I was brought up knowing that A-L-I-N-E was Aline, and then I discovered it was also Aileen and also Aline, and now every time I look at her and I know her and she's become a friend, I get completely confused. So, whatever you are.
Whoever you are.
Oh, did I draw the short straw?
You did, yes.
Well, I'm Aline Templeton. It's Gaelic and it's French. And my mother's family were from the west coast of Scotland and had Gaelic as their first language. And my father's family were originally Huguenots. So it's a combination name. So it's Gaelic, but it's not Irish. Gaelic. And it's French, and it's very restful when I go to France because everyone knows how to pronounce it. I wrote my first novel when I was six on notepaper stitched together with yellow thread. And it was called The Adventure of Mr. Wiz and Mrs. Woz, who went off together to Paris for the weekend. And if my mother hadn't laughed so much when she read it, I might have gone on to write blockbusters and now be living in tax exile in a Caribbean island. So I really have her to blame for it all. And then the only alternative, really, was to turn to a life of crime. So I wrote six standalones, and then I wrote a series involving D.I. Marjorie Fleming. And the reason I chose somebody like Marjorie Fleming is I wanted to write about the woman you'd meet if you went down the local nick. She's not a drunk. She fancies a whiskey from time to time, but she's not a drunk. She's not a dysfunctional loner. She doesn't have an attitude problem. She's got kids. She's got a normal, happy marriage, and she's got elderly parents to worry about. And she has a very difficult and demanding job. So that is my background. I was to say one of the most interesting things about myself. I know what to do if you see a rattlesnake poised to strike. I learned this from a cowboy on a Greyhound bus when I was going right across America. And what you do is you shoot a stream of tobacco juice in its eye. I share that with you.
But do you have to? That means you have to travel all the time with specially stored.
Well, the sort of thing you'd have around you all the time, isn't it? You know, always supposing I could hit anything other than a barn door with something I threw, let alone.
Well, thank you very much, Aline. That's very useful. Linda, you'll have even more obscure tech.
I don't know if I'm any more obscure than that. I'm a bit of Gaelic in me, a bored Irish girl. Same as, I wonder what you'd do if there's a no smoking sign. Would you be allowed to do it?
It doesn't say no chewing.
Or spitting, it was certainly not in America. Okay, so my name's Linda Regan. Hello, good morning. Thank you all for coming. But I was brought up in a theatrical family, so basically my work was an actor. If anybody knows anything about acting, they'll know we spend an awful lot of time resting or not working. I'm not a resting person, and I've always written. I've written probably some of the worst novels ever as a young adult child ever. Then, and I still have dreams that that the big white papers follow me around like ghosts, and somebody's actually going to discover them, even though they're burnt or hidden under the carpet, which is what I used to do with them. My first crime novel was actually published when in 2004, when I suddenly realised, I came to realise I really, truly would like to murder a lot of people. I just thought, if you're honest with me, I believe as an actor, you know, that you work from the heart. And I thought, what would I really like to do? I'd actually like to kill a lot of people. And in my profession, I always had to keep quiet because I couldn't say what I thought. So I put it down in a book. My first book was set backstage in a pantomime where all the actors were, there was a serial killer loose and the actors were killing each other. And that was my first published book, which was quite interesting, that suddenly you think, well, you're honest. I've become more and more interested in crime. I now write, I think my crime's changed slightly. I have a brand new series coming out with two new detectives, which comes out next month. It's set where I live in South London, where gang warfare is rife, and I'm actually very, very moved and touched by true violence, and I write about it because it's something I read a lot about, which brings me, I really do want to mention one of the books that touched my heart most in the last couple of years, and it is Ruth Dudley Edwards' book, Omar on the Bombing, because I know she won't mention it herself, but if you haven't read it, it's one of the most powerful books I've ever read. It's the true story of the Omar bombing and the outcome of things that accumulated after that, and I couldn't recommend it higher, so I don't want to talk about myself anymore. But anyway, that was it. I've got a new series coming out next month.
Thank you, Linda. That's very sweet of you.
It's very lovely, yes. My name is Pauline Rosen, and I think I don't know whether I'm the odd one out or the thorn here amongst the panel, depending on our title of Operation Petticoat, because I was a bit alarmed when we were first given that, because I said to Miles and Adrian, I write from the male point of view. I don't write from the female point of view. And all my novels, I've got two thrillers, and I've got five in the D.I. Andy Horton series. Number six is, I've got six actually, I've lost count now. And number seven is coming out next year, and I'm halfway through number eight at the moment. He said, oh, well, that doesn't matter, I'm sure you'll find something to talk about. So I'm sure you will, because we're women, so we're bound to find something to talk about. But it's quite interesting because both Linda and Lean, is it, mentioned about writing very young. And I don't know about Lee and Ruth, but I also was exactly the same. I wrote my first novel at 11, not 6. And I thought I was going to be the next Enid Blyton then, because I loved adventure and I loved mystery and I loved heroes. But it took me 20 years from starting to write fiction to getting published. And maybe that's because when I first started writing with an aim of getting fiction published, I wrote sagas. I don't know why I wrote historical sagas, but I wrote historical sagas and I didn't get anywhere with them. And then I thought, why am I writing sagas when I'm an avid crime fiction reader? And I love crime fiction and I love thrillers. Why don't I try a thriller and a detective novel? And up until then, I was writing from the female point of view. And when I wrote Andy Horton, my hunky detective, who's sort of late 30s, early 40s, I wrote from the male point of view, and I entered it into a competition, and I won a prize. And I knew then that I was writing the right thing. And since then, I'm very happy to say that they've gone from strength to strength. So that's just a little bit of background about myself, and that's my character, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about it as we go on this morning.
Yeah. Oh, hard act to follow there. I've been sitting here feeling more and more intimidated. Right. Now, I'm also a little bit unusual in this field in that, I wrote somewhere that I fell into writing like Alice down the rabbit hole. I didn't actually start writing until my mid-50s. Cut Short, my debut thriller, was the first novel I'd ever written. And I was extremely fortunate to find a publisher just 2 weeks after I'd sent out my first draft, which I rushed off in about 6 weeks. Mm. When I started writing, I never wrote with an intention of being published. It never occurred to me. I simply had an idea one day, and this story stayed with me, and I started to write, found I couldn't stop, absolutely hooked on writing, and I wrote purely for myself my first draft. I just loved it. And it was only when I'd finished that I thought, I've written a book here. And so I thought, well, I'll send it off. Why not? Nothing to lose. Not expecting to hear anything. So that was my debut thriller, Cut Short, which came out in 2009. And last year was shortlisted for the Crime Writers Association New Blood Dagger Award for Best First Novel. That was followed last year by Road Closed, which has also been doing very well. I'm here to promote my new thriller, which came out last week, Dead End. My books follow, they have one detective that runs through the series, a female detective inspector with a male sergeant, and she has a female detective chief inspector. And I write very much in the genre. Start with the body and off we go. In terms of anything interesting, well, since I started writing, I now know how you can determine the time of death from a severed leg, but not from a severed finger. I know why that is. I also know which police station in London serves the best Jamaican curry, and at which police station in London you can get homemade banana bread. So, that's the kind of research that I do.
Can't be very handy, doesn't it?
Yes.
And that's my books, really. Next one is coming out next year, and I'm halfway through the final and thinking about the one after that.
Thank you, Lee. Now, this is a prize for the best or most challenging question, so please be prepared and on your mettle. I read a novel by every one of these excellent ladies, if I may so call them, since we're in petticoat mode, and cracking good reads, but I have to say that while I can do gruesome stuff in real life, my crime novels have no sex on the page and no violence. And I really had some nasty dreams. Linda may later, when we all get more intimate, tell you what she does with pokers. and I wanted to start by saying, asking really, are you being encouraged by your editors to make things more gruesome? Anybody care to?
No. Absolutely.
Or do you just think like that?
Yeah. Yes, no, the truth is that is what life is. That is how crime is, especially where I write. If you pick up the paper, I mean, we had two or three dead heads, I'm thinking of roses, but dead heads, heavy heads, in the rubbish bin opposite where I live, and it didn't make the paper.
Where do you live?
Real heads?
Yes, real heads. And they were looking for the bodies, and it didn't make the paper. But, you know, that's gang war. That's gang war in South London.
The woman in Spain made the paper. That poor woman who had her head.
Yes.
I remember a couple of years ago reading a crime novel, and bodies were being dismembered, and I remember thinking at the time, this is going a little bit far with the shock tactics, trying to do something a little bit more gruesome than anybody else has done. The following week in the papers, there was that case where body parts were being found around Hertfordshire. I'm kind of the opposite to you, Ruth, in a way, that in real life, I find crime is almost too dreadful to even contemplate, but somehow in fiction, it seems to become a different animal, and I can cope with it there. And I think it's maybe kind of working through one's horror and one's fears on a platform that you know is not real. Whereas in reality, there is nothing engaging or exciting about real crime.
Well, I always say that I don't do hard-boiled in my novels. I mean, I don't like reading hard-boiled crime and what I consider to be really, really gruesome or gratuitous crime, because I don't like that kind of novel. There are gory bits in it, because like you say, I mean, you have got bodies and things like that. But I don't do children, and I don't do rape, and I don't do things like that, and I don't do it just for the sake of it in there. So, and I know that some authors are encouraged to make them gruesome because some publishers feel that that is what's going to sell more. But I also think bringing in, you know, touching with what you were saying, Lee, is I think in fiction, why we write fiction is because that quite often we can get a result, we can tie it all up, and we can get justice, and we can see justice.
Sure.
We might not in all of our novels, but I think that's the nice thing about writing crime fiction, is that you can have a result, whereas in real life crime, you don't.
I mean,
yes, I feel very much, as Lee does, that real crime is horrible and I don't like it, and I don't watch horror films, and I don't read, if I possibly can avoid it, very graphically described crime novels. As you say, you have a crime and you have to give the reader some impression of how that looks when you find it. But on the other hand, the problem I really think with gratuitous and graphic violence, is, you know, once you've done maggots and intestines, what do you do for an encore? And you get a sort of ridiculous pornography of violence where it gets more and more and more outrageous. And I can remember being forced to read a book by an author, a highly, highly successful author whom I shall not name, who writes sort of crime horror. And I was terribly worried about reading it because I don't like horrible things lodging in my mind because you do get nightmares about them. But I just kept bursting out laughing because it was so ridiculously over the top. And it was so obvious that he was trying to shock me. Well, I said he was trying to shock me. That I just thought this is hysterical. you could give readings and people would just fall about. So I think you have to very much watch how. I think you should use it sparingly for effect.
That's and like writing a good sex scene, though, isn't it?
Well, I haven't done that. I think everything I wrote would be even funnier than
you. If you don't write it well, and I, you know, yes. there's a little bit of sex in mind, but not lots of sex. Sorry, there's lots of sex in but if you don't write it right, it's the same sort of thing, isn't it? You can actually make it's funny instead
yes.
of
yes, it is absolutely.
But I think there is a fine line, isn't there? Because I don't like to gloss over violence, and I certainly don't like to glamorize it. I mean, violence is shocking and it's horrible, and it needs to be treated with in a way with sort of respect that is what it is. And of course, there's the fallout. One thing that I do try to deal with in all my novels is the effect of violence
yes.
on other people. I've got a quotation from Gwen Adsad at the beginning of Dead End. She said, "When you kill somebody, you change the universe." And of course, when somebody is killed, it's not just that life that has gone. It's the life of the people around them. What about the person who's sitting at home waiting for that person to come home and then has to receive that shocking news? What about if that person has children? That's going to be with them, has partners, people who love them. That's going to be with them for the rest of their lives. And I think that's another area, you know, the ripples that go out, I think are desperately important. And to write about violence just for its own sake, I think is, you know, gratuitous violence. I don't really, you know, violence itself doesn't inspire me, and I don't know why anybody would want to write about it just for its own sake. But it does have a place. If you're writing murder stories, people get killed. You can't just gloss over it and pretend that these things haven't happened.
Well, that's something that all your books had in common that I very much liked, and I liked all the books. You do write like women, even if you're writing from a male point of view, Pauline.
Right.
You know, that the detective has his emotional problems.
He does, yes.
He does indeed. And that is something that, I mean, you do stiff upper lip and all the rest of it, but really the private lives of these people you've all made very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And they're very human books,
yes.
all of them.
Yes.
I mean, are women better at that?
I don't know. I think it's quite an interesting question. In my past career, marketing and PR, and also training in lecturing in psychology and things like that, women have a very different style of communication to men. Mm. There are some men who have the female style of communication in that they are much better at the social aspect and the emotional aspect, if you like. So I think that, you know, having worked in a male environment for so long, I sort of looked at the difference between men and women and how they communicate. And I like to try and sort of bring that into the books, you know, obviously not obviously in them. But, you know, some of my men have got that female style of communication. They are in touch with their emotions, and other are real alpha males, you know. And there are some alpha females, the sort of people that we've all met in our careers. And a bit like Linda said, you know, she's got a list of people that she'd like to murder.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And it's very good, because when you think about some of the people in your life that you think, they were really horrible to me and they were really nasty, and I always put them in as baddies, you know, so or victims, so I can kill them off.
Yeah,
it's quite an emotional thing. I mean, I sidetracked there, but
I think we all
yes,
do that. Don't
yes, we do.
This is why crime writers are the nicest people
yes.
in the world.
Just one other thing, just quickly picking up on what Lee said. I actually do have a crime in my family. My great aunt was actually murdered in 1959, and it is an unsolved case, and it does touch the whole family.
Yeah.
And my family are so raw about it that I'm unable to even write a true life crime about it, and I've been fighting to get the case reopened without any success for many years. So, you know, and maybe that's
come from leafy suburbs of Edinburgh.
Well, we don't have that sort of thing.
No heads and bins.
No heads and bins. But I think one of the things in a crime novel that if it is set in the seedy streets and there's a crime, you sort of go, yeah, well, it would be, that's awful, isn't it? If you have a crime set in an area where it wouldn't normally happen, it hits the headlines. You know, when you get crimes, there was a banker in Inverness who opened the door one day and somebody just shot him, and you know, that was in the papers for days. Mm-hmm. Because it was so random and shocking. Mm-hmm. And he lived in a quiet place, there was nothing, I mean, that one's still unsolved. It is far more shocking when it is in a setting that, to be fair, most people are familiar with. I mean, clearly in South London you live in a different world, but most people live in rather safe, comfortable worlds, and yet all the time you're surrounded by people with terrible problems. I mean, I was thinking supermarket queues. Mm. You know, you stand there and say, and you put in the little divider and you say thank you, and you say nice day, and you know, everybody says that sort of thing. And you know, there will be people there who are seething with hatred about something, or who are desperately miserable, or you know, whose husband has just walked out, whose wife's gone off with a lover, and you know, and they've all got their little, they're just old and lonely and terribly miserable, and all that is around you all the time, and that I think is the sort of fabric of the novels I write.
Yes, yeah.
But Linda, you're more dealing with people who do this for a living. Criminal living.
My new book's about gang warfare. I don't know that they do it gang. I think gang warfare is very sad because it's about teenagers with nothing in their lives. So that's how gangs seem to start around London. It's a living. It's a way of life. It's a way of surviving, and it's the only way of surviving. I don't know how bad. I know that gang warfare is bad in certain places like Birmingham, and there are certain areas north Glasgow. I always say, as an actress, I always used to say, you know what, I can judge the town, because every town looks the same when you're on tour. I used to say, I can judge the town by the pigeons. If we go to Windsor, all the pigeons are fat. if you go to Liverpool, they're all thin and scrawny, no necks. You go to Glasgow, they've all got one foot. I mean, that's sort of... And I sort of come from South London, where gangs and...
They're all decapitated.
Yes, there's no heads left, let alone pigeons. But I try to... When I write a book, I would try to look inside that. The violence is there, and I would never take it off the... I would never shy away from it, because it lives and it exists. But I do try to look under it, and there's always something. In my new book, there's a boy who doesn't actually want to be in the gang. How do you get away from that when you've got no parents, when you're on a high rise? If you're a loner, you'll get killed. You know, there are other... I want to go back to your book on Omar. I'm sorry to go back to it, but that there's a lot of, there is violence, because that's actually what happened. You know, that book had such an effect on me because that violence happened, and look at the effect that had on everybody all around that we were talking about there.
Oh, that was the terrifying thing when I was doing that book. It's not just the families, it's the ripple effect. Mm-hmm. It's the cousins, it's the grandfathers. Exactly. With one grandfather who died a few days after the Omar bombing, it's the neighbours,
yeah.
It's the friends, it's the work colleagues,
yes.
The ripple effect is absolutely,
yes,
terrible.
Yes.
And
I
it goes on, doesn't it, because you were saying your sad case in your,
yes,
family happened,
yes,
in the 1950s.
Yes.
And
yes.
Still,
yes,
yes,
it's because, yes, you still want justice.
Yes, you still,
yeah,
want justice, and sadly, you know, two of the sons have died now, so, and the daughter, Edwina, I mean, she finds it terribly hard to even talk about it. But she had to give up a very successful career on the stage and in television in order to bring the children up, because there was no mother, because her mother was killed,
exactly,
and murdered. So her life changed completely. And there's quite a lot of, I mean, it would be a really good book in,
yeah,
its own right, because there's,
yeah,
quite a lot of scandal behind it, which is why the police and the Freedom of Information Act won't release the papers for another 35 years.
Do you think you know who did it?
So the police think they got the right person. He got acquitted. He's still alive. And I don't think they will release the papers. And with DNA testing now,
mm-hmm,
truth is more is more frustrating than fiction, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think like Pauline was saying, one of the attractions, one of the reasons why crime fiction is so appealing is because we do generally get some sort of resolution at the end. And I think this ties in a little bit with what you were saying about violence, because crime fiction really at root level is good versus evil, isn't it? And so if you have, you know, the more violent your criminal is in a way, the more your reader is invested in them seeking, you know, finding justice at the end. But one thing that area that I find sort of interesting and a little bit tricky is that I always need to see the world through my character's eyes in order to create them. And that applies to my villains as well. I don't know if there are people who are totally evil. Certainly there are people who are so damaged that they can't function in a moral universe. But if you're going to see the world through your villain's eyes, how can you make them evil enough? Because you have to understand where they're coming from. How can you then make them evil enough for your reader to really want them to get caught? And this is something that I think
you've cracked that one.
Go into the victim story.
Yes, I mean, certainly in Cut Short, in my debut novel, I did feel that my killer was as much a victim as the people that he killed. But I think if you have too much sympathy for your villain, then it kind of throws the balance of good versus evil.
But you're talking about sympathy there as opposed to empathy, really. Because, you know, when you understand, you may not sympathise exactly, but you can be behind the person and looking through their eyes without actually thinking, oh, what a shame.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
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 Yes. Yes.
The,
you don't condone their behaviour.
Yes.
I think that's the ability of a good writer, whether it's crime or whatever genre, is you do have to have that ability to step inside your character's shoes. And you've done that, you know, we've all done it. Linda's probably extremely good at it because she's an actress as well, and actresses and actors need to step inside whichever character they're portraying their shoes. And I always found my marketing background's good because I had to market to people who were totally different to me, an 80-year-old man or a 6-year-old child or whatever. So you have to be able to step inside your customer's shoes or whatever it is and think like them. So I think, you know, a lot of authors have to do that, don't
Yes, you? Well,
you
certainly do. Yeah. One of the things I found quite interesting going from standalones to a series was that in the standalone, you're actually telling the story like that, and the police come in to help solve it, and are minor characters, really. And I think to some extent, I still feel that when I'm writing in the series, that it's about the story that's going on into which the police come. And yes, it's a police procedural, and yes, the lives of the police are the sort of the soap opera, if you like, the stories of what happens to them and what continues to happen to them. But there is this sort of solid body of story, which is the interaction between the people who are involved in the crime.
Is that because their lives go on? Because it's a series?
Because it goes,
Or if there's a reason why the police have an involvement, like maybe a policewoman's been raped or some reason, and there's a rape victim, then you can you can hope to get the reader then to, you know, empower this particular police person to find that rapist, because they know how she's going after that one because I know how she feels.
Yes.
One thing that I'm always curious about with series, because it certainly happened to me, is that you accumulate a lot of baggage, which goes from book to book, and my people acquire friends.
Yes.
And wives and all sorts of things. And then I think, my God, I've now got about 12 characters to go from book to book. And there's
a
parrot. There's a parrot.
You have to remember
a cat.
I think the parrot should have a book.
And then I don't know what
to
do with them. You know,
yes,
I send them abroad for a long period.
The parrot repeating something they've heard somebody say.
How do you deal with that?
Well, my proudest boast is that one of my characters has got a sort of god dog. I wrote in Lamb to the Slaughter, there was a greyhound, and actually I don't often put real people into my books, but this was a real greyhound, and I described her very, very meticulously because she was a lovely dog. And
are you a dog person?
I'm a very dog person.
Yes, I am. See, that's what I mean.
And the greyhound I knew, sadly, is chasing rabbits in heaven. Are the sort of rabbits where they catch them, but it doesn't make fun. But the greyhound in the book was very strongly described, was definitely a character. And I got a wonderful email from a reader in Canada saying that she'd only ever had cats, she'd never had a dog in her life, but somehow this dog haunted her. And she went out and got a retired greyhound. Yeah. And she sent me a photograph. And I was so thrilled, because you know, that was a dog that got a good home. That was someone who'd never known dogs before.
And you were somebody who got your heart into that character.
I had, and you know, that was, I don't really often write a great deal about dogs. They sort of are a thing in the background. But that was a wonderful sort of little spin-off character, because that's what happens in a series. You have these little spin-offs that are really nothing to do with the crime at all. And actually in my early books, my earlier ones in the series, I've taken a problem in the countryside, because you know there is this attitude that life in the countryside is all apple trees and gingham curtains and preserves on a little nice little shelf. And actually, poverty and crime in the countryside is every bit as grinding, and particularly poverty can be far more grinding than in the town where there are a lot of support systems. And there are specifically country problems which have had terrific effects on communities. And my first book was set against the background of the foot and mouth disease, which was simply dreadful. And I'd been feeling sympathetic to police in the area, who would know the people they were dealing with, because in small communities you do, and even so would have to tell them, I'm going to force you to let the killing squads onto your land to wipe out your flocks. So with the usual sadism that authors exhibit, I made my DI a farmer's wife, which was a nice little catch. But the second one was about fishing villages where the fishing has gone, and you have a lot of young men like the gangs in London, who are bred to a very rough and quite wild life, suddenly with nothing to do, who get into trouble. The fourth one was hamlets, which are so pretty that they're bought up by people from the city and the locals can't afford it. Another one on the background of a supermarket. Those were all subplots, really. I mean, none of them had to do with the crime, but that was the sort of background, as well as the families.
Anyone else got something to add?
I think that's quite interesting. It's a spin-off from what we've been talking about, because the setting of your novels is very important. So setting them against the sort of right backdrop. And you're talking about the countryside. You're talking about urban setting. Mm-hmm. And mine is set against the backdrop of the sea on the Solent around Portsmouth and the Isle of Wight. And my detective lives on a boat because he's been chucked out of his family home by his horrible wife. But I haven't had anybody email me yet to say that they've decided to take up sailing as a result of reading my novels, but maybe they will. So he goes from the police to this small, big police force to this small contained world where he lives on his boat because he's got a lot of personal, as you say, emotional baggage. But the setting is also quite important because the sea is ever changing, so there's always something going on. And where Portsmouth is a very vibrant city, it's also a very violent city.
Yes,
it's very affluent and it's very poor. It has contrasts, and I like to contrast the sort of urban side, Portsmouth, with a port with all its drug-related problems and easy access from London. We get the London villains down and the prostitutes and whatever, with the Solent, with the sea, which is always changing, you can't control it. And the Isle of Wight, which is, again, completely different to Portsmouth, which is a beautiful place. So I think, our settings of our crime novels are very different, and they're very important and very atmospheric. And I like the aspect of the contrast as well. So I think, that I don't know what the audience think, but I know that when I read a novel, wherever it's set, I like to get that feel of, the atmosphere and the geography from it.
I have to confess that setting is not my strong point. I'm a people person, and it's characters that interest me and what motivates them. And
I think that does me as well. I'm not saying
just
an
additional
character. No, but you have both. Yeah, you have both.
But I'm
not very good with the location. And in fact, when I started writing, and as I said, I hadn't really planned this because I didn't expect that what I was writing would be published. I hadn't actually, a lot of authors plan what they call the arc of their series when they start off, and they have an idea of where their main character is going to go.
Nope.
But when I had no idea it was going to be the start of a series, let alone a book. So
I don't think you do, though, because I know when I started D.I. Andy Horton, I thought, yeah, I'd love it to be a series, but I had no idea whether it was going to be published or not. And you start it, and you don't know it's going to become a series. And I think that goes back to what you were saying about what you create in it, because suddenly you've created a character or a friend or a parrot or a dog or whatever. You think, oh God, why did I put that in there? What am I going to do with it now?
Yes, yes,
how am
yes.
I going to get rid of it?
Yes, kill it off.
Yeah.
Yes, when in doubt, kill it.
But
yeah,
firstly, sometimes,
yeah.
sometimes you have a character who is just a minor character, and
yes.
then as you go through this, you can bring them back. You can think, oh, actually, I could do something with that character who was mentioned
oh, yes.
earlier
yes.
on.
Oh, yes, you
so
true.
Yeah.
You do.
It's
fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah. But when I started writing, I set my first three books in Kent, and I held my hands up. I looked at the map, and I found a blank space on the map, and I just made up a town in the middle of it.
Mm,
that's like, don't you think that? And I think Pauline has a very good point with. Because locations, because all our policing is so different.
Mm.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I mean, I'm
yes.
still Met. I'm Kent.
Yes.
I'm on the edge of Kent,
mm.
and you're Kent
mm.
Constabulary,
yes.
and you're Hampshire.
Mm.
So I think what we have to kind of be aware.
Yes.
Because
I
know Met and where you are, it's Swanley is our line, and it's just that the rules
different.
Are
yes.
just different.
Yes.
And
I mean,
my God, that cannot happen.
Relocating. She's relocated in my fourth book. She's moved from Kent. To London because I'm actually
okay.
tackling this thing of in fact in Dead End I do actually have quite a detailed description of a real place. It's the first time I've done it. It's
right.
I say it's a weakness of mine. It's not my strong point location, but I'm, you know, it's a new challenge, and so I've moved her to London, and there is a lot of difference between the way the police operate, yes, in the home counties and in the Met.
My last
and she has to
my
deal
last
with.
Inspector's widowed. I wonder if perhaps he could meet yours. And
yes.
We
can write a book together.
It's a very nice thought.
Have you got a single man?
A single man. Yes, he's single.
Yeah.
Yes, he's widowed.
No
yes.
Yes.
Anyone
so
got a question? Yes, please.
They face different challenges, I think, in the workplace, perhaps.
Yes.
One of the things that I've looked at a little bit in my books, I've got a female inspector, but she has a female chief inspector, and I see her in a way as the next generation to the Jane Tennysons. So what is the experience of working in the police force like for women now who come in, who are working for women who broke through that glass ceiling?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make life easier for them? Or do the women who are now their superior officers think, well, I had to, you know, fight to get where I am, so you have to fight. And it's in the background in the novels, this kind of gender politics. And she has a male sergeant. So it's not the main topic of the book, but it is in the background, this sort of gender politics.
It's interesting because
it's the same in a lot of areas of work.
Generally, I think that work is changing for women for our place. That we don't have to fight as, I'm not saying we don't fight, because we do, but I think it's a different fight now to how it was 10,
mm.
20 years ago. And I think there are more women coming up now in the police than there were, and it's an edge easier. Once they get there, it's not. I have a lot of friends in the police, and one of them is a top female DI, and, you know, a lot of the sexism is the same, which is why my new book, I wanted to write a black DI, big female DI, because I wanted to face everything that she, you know, that she would have to face. But I think it is very different.
I mean, that's quite another interesting. Sorry, that's another interesting point about. Sorry, are you saying about men and women, but also the different ethnic groups,
yeah.
or that you're going to. Could you,
yeah.
you just sparked me off. I've got a guy called Hans Alibo in mine, and he's a DI undercover in the drug squad.
Yeah.
Based on somebody I met in London, lovely man. but that's another thing that when I was asked recently by a producer who's hopefully going to put D.I. Andy Horton into a series on television, but don't hold your breath because this could take forever, and they said to me, you know, we need some other ethnics
yes.
in
yes.
it,
yes.
you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
but I have got, you know, Hans Lebo, who's from the Belgian Congo, and I have got DCI Harriet Lee, who's half Chinese, half English.
Yes.
So, sorry, it's not your question, but you just sparked me about are we all writing with, you know, the whites in our books? Or do we have a vast range of different...
My books are set in Southwest Scotland, and actually... It would be terribly artificial to put in a lot of the characters, because they don't exist there, really.
Once you move to London,
discrimination, actually, in the sort of metropolitan police forces, I think it's quite different. But I think, I mean, I know that the first woman DI was only appointed quite recently in Galloway, in Dumfries and Galloway.
I'm curious if you feel that your readers have certain expectations about how their female or male sleuths should behave. One of the critiques of my writing is that they couldn't figure out if it was a male or a female character for quite a few pages. And
what was their name?
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah, the real person. Oh, it was written.
And Sarah Caldwell, famously, nobody ever knew if her central character was male or female, called Hillary, and people still argue about it.
Yeah. But do you find that the readers have expectations they want to be able to slot their sleuth into either a female role with all of the petticoat nonsense, or
make him interesting, I'd say.
Yeah.
Make him want to turn the page.
I think one of the things that I didn't realise when I wrote from the male point of view was I just wrote because it suited my style, was that I would get male readers, you know, and I have...
And female readers.
And female readers, yeah, I have to say that.
Who fancy
my DI
horse. Yes, exactly.
So, but that was not in my head at all, and it wasn't until they were published and, you know, you get out there that I discovered that I had a male readership as well as a female readership, and across all ages, which is very rewarding. So whether men, I don't know, maybe the audience said, whether men like to read a female, you know, character, strong character or not.
I think I've got probably as many male fans as female fans.
Yeah, even
fans
with female,
and
I don't know.
Fantastic reviews from male reviewers,
which
kind of surprised me a bit. I don't know why when I think about it, but I just feel that I write as a woman, and some people have said, because I have this androgynous name, Lee Russell, some people have said that they didn't realise that I was a woman writing.
Woman,
a lot of people say they did realise.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that I have one scene in my first, Cut Short, where my DI, she's been out for the night. I mean, this is the closest that I get to writing about sex, that she wakes up in bed next to a gentleman, and that's all I say. She's not been home.
The asterisk.
My publisher said to me, can we put some sex in here? I'd be too embarrassed. I know I wouldn't write it up. Anyway, she gets summoned to a crime scene, you know, and she has to dash off. And as she arrives, there's a bunch of angry women waiting there. And she looks in the mirror, and her mascara's all smudged, and she can't find a tissue. That sort of detail, I honestly don't think there are many men who would think about a woman character stressing over the fact that her mascara smudged and she looks awful, and I feel that is such a giveaway that I'm a woman.
I think the acid test is Pauline, do you put a lot of music into your books?
Music?
Yes.
No.
Because men do.
No,
male
really.
Books are all full of music. So that's
a lot of questions there, yes.
It's very logistically and figures wise, I'm afraid us women, we're really on the up when it comes to murder. Mm. It's true. Mm.
But are there differences in motivation?
I think certainly in my book so far, every villain, every killer has had completely different motivations. And that's one of the things that really interests me about writing crime fiction. What is it that motivates one person to kill another person? That is such a big question, and it touches on such deep issues of, you know, good and evil, life and death. And to try and
get inside the psyche of, I mean, a Crime Time said that in my books they take you into the darkest recesses of the human psyche, which I think is a great quotation. To try and get inside the head of somebody who kills somebody else, it's quite a journey. And so far all of my killers have had completely different motivations. I'm exploring different ways and different reasons, and I think they're just multifarious. There are so many different possibilities. I honestly don't know whether women and men, whether there's a difference.
There are a lot of evil women,
but
well.
So far I think every individual can be totally different.
They say a large percentage is still said of it's close to home, it's family.
Yes.
Yes.
In real life,
are the sick, the very sick people,
mm-hmm.
you know, who will just,
or
you know, the Lord is my shepherd and I have to kill
yes.
prostitutes, the Yorkshire
mm.
Ripper, you know, there are different, it's, or it's an emotional thing that's, do you think, oh my God, it's just
okay, at the back there.
Oh.
No, you, because your hand was up earlier.
Yes,
and you look back. You wonder where it's come from, really.
Mm.
Yeah.
You wonder where it come from. I haven't had,
there's
nothing
yeah.
not yet,
no.
anyway, that I've looked back and thought, my God, did I rewrite that? No.
I mean, I wouldn't reread my books because I don't like watching myself on television, but if I wrote it, I just think, well, that's what came out of my emotion at the time and how I felt, and that's it. And if somebody's bought it, thank you.
Yes.
Helen Mirren's Jane Tennant was a very strong female protagonist. Has her depiction of television changed anything for women in police departments, and has it changed any the ways you write about being on the eye?
No, not at all,
no.
As far as I'm concerned. I don't know how it affects, I doubt if it affects it much in the police forces, but it certainly didn't affect me at all. I mean, I enjoyed them, but it didn't make me think anything different.
But sorry, just show me. Certainly not for me, because I go to the police once a week and I have a couple of close DI females and I watch them carefully. I worship Helen Mirren's work, but I prefer to do it firsthand.
I have got a DCI, my Andy Horton's got a female boss, a DCI, Lorraine Bliss, and she's, I don't know whether she's Jane Tennyson or not, but she's an alpha female, and she is very, very, very ambitious and thinks that she's got to fight very, very hard to get to the top. And she's certainly modelled on a lot of women that I've worked with and that I've known in the past.
And police, I think that's very right.
Yeah,
I think police do have to work,
they do have to work harder,
and I think you're very right.
And I think she's also probably got a bit of the Queen Bee syndrome in her, because again, having met lots of women who I've had to struggle, say, I've had to struggle to get to the top, you know, I'm not going to help anybody else down below me, particularly other women. They see other women as a competition as well.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And I think it probably is very competitive.
Yes, I think it is very
competitive. So,
you're right.
Yeah.
Women are able to have a higher pain threshold than men. Do you think women and men describe pain differently in their books?
What an interesting question.
It's interesting to describe, isn't it?
I've got no idea, but what a fascinating question.
I think everybody's pain threshold, whether they're men or women, is different anyway. Because I know my mother has got an incredibly high pain threshold. She doesn't feel pain, you know, at all. So whereas other people will go, oh God, I've got an earache or whatever it is, and she can watch her hips being replaced on television while the surgeon's soaring away. You know, so I think everybody's different, but I've no idea whether there's any difference.
It's a difficult thing.
I guess emotional pain.
Men always want to believe that women have a higher pain threshold, hence man flinging the rest.
Emotional
reading is a two-way process, isn't it? When you're reading a book, you're not just reading what the writer has put on the page, you're also bringing your own experience to bear on what you read. And so, I mean, pain is such a difficult thing to describe, isn't it? And it's such a personal thing. But I think in writing about pain, you kind of try and describe the pain so so that your reader will understand it in whatever way they're going to understand it, and it might appear different to every reader. So, but it's a difficult thing to describe.
I suppose that's
it
also
like
the level of gore, isn't it? You know, what do you put in? I don't consider mine sort of hard-boiled and gruesome yet. I know somebody who reads and says, I can't read them, especially at night, because I'm going to have nightmares. So you bring to what you're reading. Whereas somebody else will say, gosh, that, you know, that's nothing.
Well, yes. I mean, I was talking to a reading group one time, and one woman, she actually said she doesn't like to walk in her local park anymore after reading Cutshaw. And I thought,
And
at the same time, somebody else in that reader group said, I was expecting a bit more violence.
Yes.
So,
I had a friend who doesn't normally read crime novels, and she was reading mine in a car park, waiting for her husband to arrive. And she said she found herself
locking the car. Yeah.
Anyone else? Because you do pain. I mean, you describe pain.
Do I?
Yes. I seem to remember in the last one.
Yes. I mean, I
it didn't
don't
go on very long.
I don't gloss over these things. I mean, I do in some ways object to things like, well, I can't think of any examples, but when you see these films, when you get the hero who's, you know, punched so many times and kicked
him, not scratch
and
on
they just get up and carry on fighting. And you think, no, if somebody had kicked you like that, you would actually need to be rushed to hospital. You'd be in absolute agony, you know. So I try not to, I try to tell it as it is. Pain is horrible. And it's one person making another person suffer. It is not nice, and there's nothing nice about it.
But of course, it's hard to write. If you write from the heart, you write from experience, and you haven't had your head blown open by a pistol recently, it's quite hard.
Oh, but that's imagination.
I think
isn't
you wouldn't
I mean,
feel
I,
much pain.
I've never killed anybody.
Time, ladies, please. Thank you very much. Now, I'm going to arbitrarily, it's not quite arbitrarily, I'm going to give the prize to you, because I've never heard anybody ask the question.